The sun has just set in Kuwait City. The streets are empty. There is little sound except for the distant reverberation of gunfire shots. The electricity is intermittent, as it has been on many nights lately. And at that particular moment, the electricity is off, and so the city, at least in that part, is largely dark. And there you are, a Kuwaiti national, loyal to the emir, a nationalist who hates what has happened and the devastation done to your city and to your country, resents Saddam Hussein and the invasion of the Iraqis. And then there is a knock, a soft knock, at your door. You go and you open it slowly, and it is only by the light of the moon that you are able to make out the features of the person who there stands. Someone who you remember meeting just a couple of days earlier at the marketplace, but before that, a complete stranger to you. He speaks quickly, with a nervousness to his voice. He tells you that he is part of the underground and that they are involved in hiding Americans and other Westerners so that they are not captured and become hostages of the Iraqis, and that he himself was almost captured and no longer has a place to stay, and so asks if he may stay at your house. And you have one of those experiences that may be fairly frequent in life, where within a few seconds it is as if hours of thought had been concentrated, condensed, where you weigh quickly, far more quickly than anyone observing ever could imagine, the alternatives that you face and are considering. You think to yourself that here is someone who is desperate and in need, and you really need to offer all of the help that you can. But on the other hand, if you offer help and you are caught, what does that mean? Might you not be hung on the gallows where you have seen others from your community hung in recent weeks? Or perhaps you should just simply turn that person away, and yet, are you then not helping the invaders? Are you not, in fact, ending that person's life because might he not quickly be caught? And so probably you should let him in and let him hide in your home and stay there for several days or perhaps even weeks. Although there's another fear, almost a tremor that runs through you, the concern that he may be on their side. For you have heard stories told that there are Kuwaitis who have sold out to the Iraqis, and because of that they are out trying to find out who would hide the Westerners and who would be disloyal to the man whose picture is now being plastered throughout Kuwait City. What do you do? How do you decide? When do you make that decision? It would, it seems to me, be an extremely difficult decision to make. I mean, a life and death matter on the spot and with pressure against you to make it quickly. But then again, few of life's great decisions are easy decisions, and often, most of the time, we do not have adequate time to think them through and consider all of the alternatives and all of the options that are before us. Sometimes we're absolutely sure what is right. On other instances, it's hard to figure out what's right and what's wrong. And when we do finally conclude what is right, right can be a very hard thing with very high cost for us to do. Well, I take you again to the Middle East, to another dilemma at other doors, faced by Christians long ago. It was their dilemma that precipitated the writing of a couple of peculiar verses in one of the smallest books of the Bible. That is 2 John. 2 John that we have been studying on Sunday mornings has in verses 10 and 11 some words that I admit to you are strange and at first reading may even seem to be unchristian, quite contrary to the ethic of Jesus Christ that we have found elsewhere in the Bible. The words are these. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked ways. What's the background for these peculiar words? The background is one of heresy. For there were in those days pseudo-Christians who would not affirm that Jesus Christ is both fully God and fully human. And they were becoming, to the Christian community, to the church, like a virus that was spreading throughout the body contaminating it and potentially fatal in its consequences. And let me tell you what I think is a basic principle, and that is that the best answer to error is truth. That it is not the best approach to take on error and spend the majority of our time, energy, and resources in fighting it. But the best way is to simply proclaim the truth and put our energy and our time and our resources into that. Because when the truth is proclaimed, it by its very nature is anti-error. And so that's what St. John and the other apostles and disciples and missionaries of the first century did. They spent comparatively little time combating error. And they spend most of their time proclaiming truth, the truth about Jesus Christ, that he was then, in fact, is now, fully God and fully human. In fact, 100% God and 100% human. And while that adds up to a percentage higher than our mathematics allow, supernaturally that is true, and eternally that is a fact. It is revealed by God, and it is an absolute that the early church carefully and wisely taught. It was important because Jesus is unique. He is one of a kind. And because he is one of a kind, he alone is the one who is able to remedy the dilemma of human sin. For when he died on the cross, it was he who paid the price and he who purchased for us a place forever in heaven. If it had been anyone else than he who was 100% God and 100% human, it would have simply been a death, and it would not have been transferable nor beneficial to all of the rest of us sinners and humankind. So believing in Jesus, in who he is, in what he did, was and is essential to be the truth as far as our getting to God, our forgiveness, our fullness of life, and our forever in heaven. It's the truth, and it is the teaching. I mean, it's all throughout the Bible, throughout the New Testament. But even though the truth was taught, there still was this lingering problem of anyone who comes to you and does not bring you this teaching. And the lingering problem was those with the heresy that Jesus was something less than fully human, and what to do with them, especially in terms of hospitality. It was at a time when the Roman Empire was at or near its peak, and one of the reasons was because they had such a marvelous transportation system. In fact, Roman roads, many of them, are still available today. They have lasted these thousands of years. So there were great roads that tied the empire together. It was more than a conquering army. It was a network and a fabric of society. And there were great shipping patterns across the Mediterranean. What there wasn't was an infrastructure of hotels or motels or places of lodging. There were inns that were along some of the highways and in many of the cities. But the inns were basically terrible places. They were morally not a great deal different from houses of prostitution. They were dangerous in that people were often robbed, often beaten, and the majority of travelers would have nothing to do with them. They simply were not places that you could safely stay. The far better alternative was to stay in private homes. And so networks were set up, or strangers would go to the homes of someone they didn't even know and ask if they could stay there. For Christians, it was a particularly good approach, because as missionaries and evangelists and Christian business persons went from place to place, they would search out the church in the community and they would ask if they could stay in someone's home. And it was great. It meant a networking, it meant a fellowship, it meant a tying together of the Church of Jesus Christ around the empire. However, the bad guys, the heretics, quickly caught on to the idea of Christian hospitality. And so when they would come into a community and they wanted to teach an error concerning the Bible or concerning Jesus Christ, they too would go to the homes of Christians, knock on the door, and ask if there they could stay. That way they could have a base of operation where they would have lodging, where they would have meals provided. And then when they weren't out trying to win others to their error, they could work on the host and hostess of their home. It was a dangerous use of a very good thing. And not just an ancient phenomenon. Earlier this year, I think it was, we asked people at Wooddale on the back of registration cards to indicate whether or not you would be open to the possibility of missionaries or others like them staying in your home, whether it be overnight or even just for a meal, or in some cases for an extended period of time, weeks or even months. And the response was fantastic. I mean, probably more than we could possibly use. So many people among us said, yes, that's something I'd like to do. And it was precisely that that was taken advantage of among those first century Christians. Now, it's out of that background of heresy and hospitality that these peculiar words of 2 John 10 and 11 were written. The teaching that it's a warning against these bad guys, these heretics. And I think a sad warning, sad that in the first century of Christianity, among people, many of whom were new Christians, but naive Christians, that they had to be warned that somebody might come and try to rip them off simply because they were believers in the truth. Sad that they had to be told, but they did. They needed to understand the reality of sin and what people do. They needed to understand that truth, by its very nature, attracts error. That when you have a currency that is valuable and correct, that will cause those who are sinners to want to counterfeit it, to try to put across something where they will get a value and it will be almost the same but different enough to make it worthless. And that's why John warns his readers, saying, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, that is the true biblical teaching of Jesus Christ, to not let them in. In other words, these first century Christians were told to check everybody out, to check out whenever possible what a teacher was teaching about Jesus Christ. Now, it's important. It's important to note that it was teachers. It wasn't just everybody. I mean, if you met somebody at the grocery store, before you said hi, you did not have to ask them to recite the books of the Bible, nor what is their doctrinal position, or anything of the sort. It was talking specifically about teachers, those who had given themselves to stand up to communicate about Jesus Christ in the Bible. And if they didn't tell the truth about Jesus Christ, then do not take them into your home or welcome him. Perhaps you heard the story of a lady who was concerned about Jehovah's Witnesses coming to her door, and a friend heard her concern and offered to her a remedy. She said, perhaps you don't know that Jehovah's Witnesses in one of their commitments do not pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States or of any other country. And so what you should do is go to the store and buy a flag and a pole and put it in the entryway to your house. And then if somebody comes to the door and you're not sure, just insist that before anybody says anything, they have to salute the flag. So this lady, being gullible as she was, went over to Sears and bought a flag and pole and got a hole drilled in the floor right inside her house and put the flag pole in there. And it was the main feature as you walked into the house. And nothing happened for several weeks. And then one day, sure enough, this stranger comes walking up carrying a little case and knocks on the door. And the lady of the home opens the door and said, now, before you say anything, I insist that you salute the flag of the United States. And so this woman, a little taken back, takes her case, moves it over to her other hand, turns and says, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, all the way through the Pledge of Allegiance. And then when she's finished, she said, you know, in all my years as an Avon lady, that is the first time that anybody has ever asked me to salute the flag. Well, the Bible wasn't asking us or asking them to check out every Avon lady or anybody who walks up the path or anything like that. It was saying that those who are teachers, those who are presenting themselves as communicators of God's truth, need to be checked out. And that checking out is required because we need to avoid expressions of solidarity and support for them. The Bible wasn't suggesting that those Christians be mean to these teachers, but rather it was warning that you cannot communicate that you support them. And let's suppose that some stranger comes in to our metropolitan area and I allow that person, in fact, invite that person to stay at our house. And that individual's selling books about some religious thing or another, and I buy one of those books from this guest in my home. And then that person meets you at the shopping center or some other place in the community, and quickly in the course of conversation says, oh yeah, I'm staying at Leith Anderson's house, and he bought one of my books. And you think to yourself, well, you know, I know him, and if he's entertaining that person, and if he buys the book, maybe then that's going to open you up to listen in a way you would not otherwise, perhaps uncritically to that person's communication, and maybe then go ahead and buy that person's book and go along with whatever that person is saying, even though it may be completely contradictory to what the Bible has to say. In other words, my solidarity and support for that individual gave him the base for expanding his teaching. Now, it's sad to have to say, be cautious. It was sad for John to have to communicate that. But the reason is that there are many people who, when you are nice to them, they think you agree with them. When you are kind to them, they misconstrue that to be approval for their teaching or for their behavior. There are sinners who, simply because you are warm and gracious, think that you are saying that you endorse whatever they have done. There's an old adage, you've heard it often, that says, love the sinner, but hate the sin. And I like that. That's good. But understand that many sinners can read love as an approval for their behavior. And the Bible taught that this problem was especially critical in terms of false teachers because the implication, the outgoing ripples, were far beyond the relationship between the Christian and the heretic. So Christians are told then that they must not entertain or even welcome heretics, lest such kindness be interpreted as an approval of their heresy. What's more, it even goes on to say that those who do these things, who express solidarity and support, become accomplices in their evil work. And we understand that because that's part of our law as well. That if you assist someone in the committing of a crime, in our legal system, you also become guilty of a crime, even though you may not have actually even been there when the crime took place. So if you provide a car and somebody robs a bank, or if you provide housing while the person who robbed the bank is fleeing from the authorities, then you become an accomplice before the fact with the car or after the fact with the house. But in either case, you also become guilty of a crime. Or you share the wicked work, in the words of the Bible. Now, all of this may sound, I don't know, kind of historical, but rather irrelevant. Because it happened a long time ago, and the chances are you're not going to rub shoulders against somebody who's saying, well, Jesus was 100% God, but he was less than 100% man. And it just doesn't quite apply to us. Well, actually, there are many principles from this that do apply to us today. There are truths and practical things that relate to our everyday life and decision. And it is good to think these things through and to process them before we are up against making the decision in the heat of a particularly pressured moment. So let's consider what they are. First is to think before giving. That we not, on the one hand, take this as an excuse to do nothing, say, well, I better be careful. I'm not going to let anybody in my door. I'm not going to be kind to anybody. I'm just going to withdraw from all the world unless I help the wrong person. That would be as unchristian as can be. Clearly, we are to continue in Christian virtue. It isn't that we should not be hospitable or that we should not be welcoming and generous and giving, but that we should think first. Think through what are the implications of this. If someone is a teacher or someone is presenting herself or himself as a communicator of God's truth, then check that person out. I'll tell you, it's scary to me. Scary. How often and how easily some Christians just give away money. It's also a little scary to me that some Christians don't give away anything, but it's scary how readily people can support a cause about which they know nothing. They have no idea really what's being taught or what's being communicated of whether it's good or whether it's bad. So before you write a check or before you endorse somebody or something or become a volunteer or get involved, think it through and check it out and make sure that what you are supporting teaches the biblical truth about Jesus Christ. It's a basic principle, but a very important one. Another principle, that's kind of a hard one, is the principle that lines must be drawn. And I think that there are at least some of us who are kind of uncomfortable with the drawing of lines, perhaps because maybe we grew up in our younger years in contexts where an awful lot of lines were drawn. In fact, there were so many lines that no matter what direction you took a step, you seemed to be crossing over one of them.
And you thought to yourself that the lines kept getting closer and closer until the box was so small that hardly anyone, including you, could stand in it. And you say, I don't want to be that way. I've enjoyed the freedom of Jesus Christ, the movement of the Holy Spirit. I like to love. I like to love people. I like to like people. I like to do God's good work and God's good things. This is just tremendous. And so I don't want to draw lines that are exclusive. I'd rather be positive than negative. And that's great. And I think in large part that captures the ethic of Jesus Christ. But it's up to a point. And that point is where lines must be drawn. For while it is true that we are to be loving and that we are to have the freedom of the Spirit and that we are to be inclusive rather than exclusive and positive rather than negative, all of that is wonderfully true and applies, I think, to the vast majority of life circumstances. It is also true that we are involved in a spiritual battle. And when battles are fought, battle lines must be drawn. And that as Christians, we have declared ourselves for God's side, and that means that we cannot support, we cannot endorse that which is evil. That we choose, because we are Christians, to stand on the side of Jesus Christ and the side of right. Now, you know, I couch this in the recognition that Jesus was the most loving person ever. Of course he was. I mean, no one could be more loving or gracious or generous or kind than Jesus. And yet when you read his biography in the New Testament, you discover that he also drew lines. Sometimes those lines were drawn with tears, but lines have to be drawn between what is right and what is wrong. You may also recall that Jesus said that when those lines are drawn and when you choose for right, that sometimes it will be at a very great cost. Sometimes it will even divide families between husbands and wives and parents and children, brothers and sisters. It can cost a lot when a line's drawn to stand on the side of right. It can be uncomfortable. It can be painful. It can be difficult. But lines must be drawn, even if drawn with tears. A third principle for us today out of this piece of the Bible is that love must be tough. And by the way, that is not a new notion that came up from somebody writing a counseling book. It is as old as the Scripture itself. You see, love always does... Christian love always does what is in the best interest of someone else. It's not selfish, it's not self-centered or self-seeking. It is always doing that which will enable and help the other person for good. Now, take that back to the first century case. The heretics come knocking at the door, and it seems as if the loving thing to do is to give them a place to stay and say hello and lodging and meals and all of that stuff. But really, that would be the unloving thing to do if it perpetuates that person's error. I mean, here's somebody who really doesn't understand Jesus Christ and really is not a follower of Jesus Christ. To help that person to continue that and then to include other people in the error would be an extraordinarily unloving thing to do. And so you say no. The line has got to be drawn, and that may be tough love. I'll tell you what's often the toughest part of tough love. It's being told by the person that you're loving that you don't love at all. So somebody knocks at the door and says, let me in. You say, no, I can't. Because you don't teach the truth about Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. And the other individual says, and you say you're a Christian? Christians are supposed to be hospitable. Christians are supposed to be loving and generous and accepting. You say, no, it's precisely because I'm a Christian. I love you enough not to help you do wrong. Even if you say that that's unloving. A fourth and a final principle for us today out of these words is the principle that we be controlled by truth rather than manipulated by error. I guess it comes down to the question of what most influences us in life. Are we going to allow our lives and our resources that we have to be manipulated by evil and by error? Or are we determined to be controlled by the truth, even if that comes at a high price? Now, of course, this is a much bigger principle than relates to staying overnight or giving somebody a meal or saying hello. It's a major choice in how we live our lives. You see, the right thing to do, the right thing, is to live for the truth. The right thing to do is to live by the Bible. The right thing to do is to live like Jesus Christ. And Christians are those who, by very definition, if anyone should choose what's right. But the right thing is often the hard thing. The easy thing is sometimes the evil thing. Now, you take all this, and I suppose for Christians at some points in history, that didn't really relate. But I think it does relate to us today, specifically because of what's happening in the current events of the world. Because, as you well know, our nation is talking war. And when you listen to the news commentators or the analysts or you listen to the politicians or the military strategists, you hear this kind of terminology a lot, that the line's got to be drawn. Now, some people may disagree on whether the line is drawn somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean or on the border between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. But everybody agrees that you don't let those who are wrong, those who are terrorists, those who are breaking the rules, advance against that which is right and good. So you draw the line somewhere. It's the recognition in our day that we have sanctions against a country that's out of line, not because we hate the Iraqis, but because we are trying to use those things to push them back to what is right and what is good. And so we seek to pressure them in the right direction. And what I'm saying is that these same principles apply to us in our everyday battles and in our ordinary lives, that every day we have to decide where the line is drawn and to stand with Jesus Christ and to stand on the side of truth and right, that our decision may be like the words of the hymn when we talk to God, actually in a prayer, and we say, by thy grace divine, we are on the Lord's side. Because, Savior, we are thine. Amen.
Don Grewick has been involved in the church's small group ministry, specifically growth groups. He comes this morning to the witness stand to tell of his experience this past year in that.
Thursday, March 8, 1990, was an ordinary day of an ordinary week. At 6 o'clock that evening, five ordinary guys met for a regular growth group meeting. Growth group is a weekly meeting where a small group of people take time to pray, study the Bible, and get to know each other better. The topic of our growth group meeting that night was how to talk about our faith in Jesus Christ with the people we encounter in our jobs, neighborhoods, and families. We all had a desire to more effectively explain to others how Jesus Christ makes a difference in our lives. At the end of this meeting, we decided to pray for a specific person that we would be seeing during the next week. We prayed that God would work in that person's life so that they would have a desire to find out more about Him. Little did we know that God was already working the lives of these people. The next 7 days were extraordinary. Unexpected things happened, and circumstances fell together in a way that we did not foresee. People at my work asked me questions about my church and my family. I responded with far more information than I'd ever dared before. The people asking the questions seemed genuinely interested. I was amazed at the sudden interest in spiritual issues. While this was encouraging, I was still apprehensive about approaching the person who I asked the group to pray for specifically. This person lives in my neighborhood. He works in construction and has an intimidating manner. He lives his life at a very fast pace and has always been negative towards church, God, and religion. He owns and operates his own business and has always had enough money to meet all of his needs. My neighbor thought that his hard work and money would carry him over any bump in his fast-paced life. I've been concerned about my neighbor for the 6 years that I've known him. When I stopped by that week for a midwinter, hello, how are you? I found my neighbor feeling empty, lonely, and lost. He told me that he was in a crisis and was searching for answers. He was dealing with problems that hard work and money could never cure. I asked him if he thought God could help. When he responded affirmatively, I knew that God created my opportunity. I explained to my friend that God loved him and had a plan for his life. We discussed why God's love and plan were not currently a part of his life. I shared with him the story of Jesus, God's Son, who lived and died and rose again from the dead so that my neighbor could have a better life. My neighbor understood it was not enough just to know this story. Jesus was standing at the door of his heart, knocking, and waiting for him to open the door and invite Jesus into his life. For the very first time, this message made sense to my friend. He asked Jesus to come into his life, to forgive his sins, and make things better. Jesus answered my neighbor's prayer. My neighbor found peace and answers to the questions that were troubling him. His life has changed forever. The following Thursday, when our group met again, I was awed to find that every person who the group had prayed for had an opportunity to find out more about God. One group member saw an antagonistic co-worker whose car had stalled, so he offered a ride home. During the ride, this person asked about God and was able to understand exactly how to have a personal relationship with God. Another member met with a truck driver who had some relationship problems that needed to be sorted out, and that conversation led to a discussion of God's role in our relationships with others. Another member saw a customer who asked some very insightful questions about God. Looking back at the events of that week, I realized that God used ordinary people and ordinary circumstances in an extraordinary way. Since that week, the opportunities to talk about God with others continued for the group. We have learned some important lessons from that week. First, God truly answers our prayers. Second, God uses groups to allow us to do things we might never accomplish on our own. And finally, God is faithful to provide answers and give courage to those who are willing to tell others about Him.